Hello, everybody, and welcome to a French Village podcast. I am joined by my brilliant friend, Ben Wittes, and we are breaking down episodes 5 and 6. Ben, hello.
Hey, Sarah Longwell. How are you?
Great. I needed a second to remember if 5 and 6 was right, but it's right.
It is. It is episodes 5 and 6, full of terrorist planning, broken hearts, multiple broken hearts, and crazed adultery with Nazis. It's an action-packed few episodes.
It is an action-packed couple of episodes, and I'm going to warn you up front that I've been thinking a lot in my rewatching about Lucienne. And I was like a big Berio person in the first go round. And admittedly, he's starting to hit his like good story arc here, where he gets to be like a real mensch. Except I just, in evaluating it in a second watching, I just want to say this. You know, we've been talking about Lucienne like as a bad decision machine. And
she is.
Okay, but here, let me just throw something at you, okay?
All right.
She has fallen in love with a German soldier. This is a tale as old as time. This is Romeo and Juliet. This is Tony and Maria.
It is Summer of My German Soldier.
Yeah. It's Beauty and the Beast, whatever. The point is that this story of love across boundaries created by others is... when was the last time you went around blaming Romeo or Juliet for not the bad decision? They make some bad decisions through the course of their whole thing, but like the decision to fall in love. We don't fault them for that. We're on their side.
Hang on a second. First of all, I think we would evaluate Juliet's decision making a little differently if Romeo were a Nazi soldier invading her town.
Okay. My retort to that would be that Romeo was a philandering jerk, part of the familial clan that had been tormenting her family directly, and had been involved in Hatfields McCoy type tit for tat for a long time.
Yeah, but first of all, the opening line of the play, Two Families Alike in Dignity, right, establishes that we're not dealing with Nazi occupier versus French villager. We're dealing with, an elite, two decent families who have this crazed hatred of each other. And so they're set up as kind of parallel. I don't think I don't want to be too hard on Lucienne for falling in love with Kurt, because Kurt seems like a nice guy despite his affinity for Bruckner. I think we can be hard on Lucienne for, getting a bunch of kids killed in the first episode. That was not a good thing to do. Secondly, being... really quite relieved when the letter of dismissal comes to the school and it's not for her, it's for her boss, because her boss is Jewish. Lucienne doesn't actually seem to have too much of a moral core, although one is kind of poking up every now and then. I also think there's an interesting little moment in the preparation for the Catherinette party or pageant or whatever it is at this in this episode, where Mrs. Schwartz, who is once again in a fierce competition with Hortense for the most loathsome person in the show, is. Goes on a tirade and behaves once again really badly and talks about, Jews and Freemasons. And then Berio stands up to her. And Lucienne later thanks him for standing up for me rather than for the more general moral stand that he took against a bully. And so I think you can judge Lucienne. Lucienne's fundamental problem is that she's dumb and and sort of narrow as a human being. She's not a bad person. She's just an insignificant person. And it portrays her, I think, I don't fault her for Kurt. I fault her for making a series of decisions that have very bad consequences for other people and herself without a lot of thought to how she gets there.
Yeah. Okay. So I agree with it, but like, this is I just think that the characterization of like, she gets a bunch of kids killed. Like, there was a German in a plane with guns that decided to strafe children who were out in an attack. And so she shows bad judgment that gets them into that predicament because she's following, as I recall, that other teacher that they seem to have like crushes on each other. We don't really get, that doesn't really get to play out because he gets hit in that attack. But I just, I don't know. I think you're right that she is, dumb might be. I think she's 20. I think that is, and not to cast, you know, aspersions on all 20-year-olds, but let's
but
just.
But you'd like her to be a sort of 20-year-old with a tiny bit of the 20-year-old rage at authority. Right? She doesn't seem to have any of that.
Well, yeah, she's Catholic. Very Catholic.
Well, as a Jew, I'm not going to, you know, like, you know, there are people who, like, she could be mad at Germans for occupying her town. She could be mad at the authority system for firing her boss. Instead, she just has this sort of pained look on her face all the time. She could be pissed off at Berio for being this kind of sweet guy who's just waiting, rubbing his hands together while her life falls apart so he can swoop in and save her and marry her, and being relentlessly obvious about it. But she's not really mad about any of this stuff. She's just, as one of our listeners put it, exhibits goldfish energy.
Yeah, I that was a great, great way to put it. Great characterization. I just will say, to cap this particular piece off, that neither Hortense or Janine, vile as both of them are the worst characters on the show.
That's true.
The worst characters, Heinrich Müller.
Yeah.
And he's a real bad guy in these episodes.
Not to be confused with Robert Mueller.
No, he was a good guy.
Yeah.
Good guy.
Proving that your name being Mueller does not end the conversation.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll just hit some of these plot points that kind of get us into what's happening. So the episode 5 starts with Dr. Larche trying to figure out where all the food is that's supposed to be there. But he can't figure out how to do the math on it. And it turns out young Sarah, who continues to be their maid at this point, has a background in some accounting because she used to help out her grandfather, and is able to help him put together what is happening to all this food that is supposed to be coming in and is instead going into the black market. This storyline is interesting because it kind of like brings a whole bunch of different characters and storylines in like together. It ties them together, right? So we see as Dr. Larche is trying to figure this out, he goes to Dick Caverne, who has been taken off his assignment as a cop, but still he's trying to get him to help him figure this out. So they kind of stake out the warehouse. They see a guy who's running this thing. They bring him in, and they figure out that not only is he the deputy prefect Servier's ne'er-do-well nephew, but they also find out that we also find out as viewers over time that this guy is somehow connected to Caberni, who gets pulled out of the river. The body gets pulled out of the river, I believe, at the second episode. And so so now you have Caberni and Schwartz, his murderer, connected to the ne'er-do-well nephew who is operating on the black market and who's now connected to Dr. Larchet, who is trying to bust these guys so he can get the food to real people. And all of that's in there together. Did I miss anything? But it all kind of centers around that storyline.
Yeah. So, and the storyline is actually over two episodes because the body is not pulled from the river until toward the end of episode six, whereas the bust of the smuggling ring, the black market ring, is the previous episode. So this is clearly going to be an important plot line, both for, you know, it causes Dick Evern to be reinstated. It also means that it also connects that to Schwartz, who, of course, killed Caverny and dumped his body in the river and is just conveniently there with Marie when the body gets pulled out of the river. Yeah, so there's a few really interesting things about this plot line. So the first is that it is making clear that Sarah Meyer, the maid, who is, as listeners will remember, Jewish, is actually turning into a significant character here. And that becomes clearer over the course of the couple episodes, as she is the other person who knows that Hortense is off cavorting with Heinrich Müller. And she is increasingly close to Larchet, Danielle Larchet, in a way that is interesting. And he clearly has very high regard for her. She has been an almost invisible kind of object sort of character so far. But now we learn that she's very smart, and she actually does the forensic accounting that helps him uncover this this black market ring. He is enormously impressed with her. And then on the Hortense side, she is bold enough to, in the second episode, express sympathy with him, which, you know, rather than staying in the character of the servant who never says anything, she actually says to him, "I'm sorry, you know, I'm sorry this is happening." And he responds to her, you know, in a kind of stoic way, but he definitely notices that she has sort of stepped out of her role as, you know, quiet object who pours coffee. And he is now like engaging with her as a human being, which is a really interesting thing across, you know, class, which of course is very, very strong. She's his servant. Across race, she's Jewish, across sort of professional lines, she's a servant who's, you know, helping him do forensic accounting, right? And so I think it's a really interesting magnifier on her as a, you know, taking this very minor character and all of a sudden, you know, injecting her into the story in ways that are subtle but also pretty significant.
Yeah, but would you say, what do you think he fancies her? Like, do you think that, or that she fancies him? Do you think that there's a little bit of a connection happening there?
I would think so. It is not explicit. And look, the line between being impressed with somebody you've never noticed and having a little bit of a crush is a fine one, I think. And the line between, in her case, admiring him greatly and deeply sympathizing with the position that he's in and having a bit of a crush is also a fine one. And so I think the show leaves it kind of ambiguous so far. the script writer in me says, of course, that's for the purpose, that's setting up something that's going to happen in later episodes. And honestly, if there are any two characters that in the show who deserve a good affair, surely it is Danielle, who, you know, whose wife is sleeping with all the worst people in the town. And poor Sarah, who's, you know, who doesn't seem to have friends or and is existing in a very hostile world. So I wish them the best, and I certainly hope they they have a little tryst.
Okay, I'm against this. You and I, our mores on this are just out of whack, because Sarah is maybe, like, I was already skeeved out by the age difference between Larche and Hortense, and I am further skeeved out between by the age difference between Sarah.
I'm not saying it's best practices. I'm just like, this is war, for crying out loud. And like, who is Sarah supposed to go have an affair with?
The guy booing at the movie theater, which is, I think, who she was, you know.
That worked out real well for her. you know, she's, you know, she's, I'm, look, I am not a big proponent of intergenerational romance, but I'm saying this is 1941 in France. You take it where you can get it.
Okay, I'm just going to point out, though, that you're very against the Kurt Marie or the Kurt Lucien, you know, romance where...
Because, like, it can get people killed. It gets Kurt sent to the Eastern Front.
Oh,
that's like a fucking death sentence.
Okay, well, I don't know if you've noticed, but Larche's wife is, like, shacking up with the most vicious human alive. So, like,
I haven't exactly endorsed that.
But I'm just saying that Larche, you know, and actually I'll just hit this plot point here. You know, one of the things that happens in this episode that I think is interesting is that Hortense, after taking great pains to make up this, like, story about her cousin, and then no, she was really with Jean, which is already a bad thing. Now she just, like, comes out with it. Like, he's got patients waiting. She tells him he's got patients waiting. And then she just decides, you know what? What's happening with us, Daniel? I want to tell you, I'm having an affair with the German, the most vicious German in town. And so he is, like, he's personally betrayed by this. I'm not sure why he's so shocked by Hortense. Her nature is now abundantly clear. But I will say one of the things that is that he goes to Kollwitz, the colonel, the German officer, and says, like, this guy's sleeping with my wife, and that should stop. And Kollwitz comes down on Mueller for it, and Mueller basically says, why would I listen to those guys? But it gets through, like, it runs the chain there. But it never seems to occur to Daniel to be afraid. Whereas if I was in that situation, I think I would be nervous about the fact that my wife was having an affair with somebody who would have now a tremendous amount of incentive to have me out of the way.
Yeah, so I think that's really interesting, and I hadn't thought about it before this exact moment. So the following thoughts may be a little scattered. But I think Danielle understands at some instinctive level that he has a certain protexia, that it is convenient for everybody for there to be a mayor of this town who can talk to everybody, who can dine with the German officers and the German policemen, who can talk to the commies, because his brother is one of them, who can... you know, who has a line directly to Vichy through the deputy prefect. I mean, it is convenient for everyone for Danielle Larche to exist. And whether he understands that at a conscious level or whether it just reduces his fear, I do think he operates with the understanding that nobody wants anything to happen to him, which is, of course, why, to jump to a different plot point, which I'm sure we'll discuss later, at the end of episode 6, he volunteers himself as a hostage, you know, because he kind of knows they're not going to shoot him.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. So, can I just, while we're on the Hortense-Daniel thing, I just think that this relationship is weird. And also, she comes over to the house, like, in the later episode after she's kind of moved in with Mueller, she's being put up at a hotel by him. And she, like, comes in to, like, hang with Takiero. But this is one of the things, I think I might have mentioned it before, that just bugs me about, that I find totally unbelievable in any context, including this war one, is that you basically adopt this kid. You go to all these great lengths to ensure that nobody knows the truth and to make sure that he shares. And then, like, she just, like, dips out on him. And Sarah is basically raising him. And she has this weird conversation with Daniel where he's kind of like, are you going to come back? And she says, which I don't even understand, like, why he wants her back. But okay, he's saying he's very tolerant. Maybe this is just a French thing. They're all very tolerant of the affairs. Like, nobody ever suggests perhaps we should get divorced because of this, or perhaps this isn't working. Everyone's just like, I'm having an affair. Like, Schwartz is having an affair. And
Divorce was mostly illegal at this point.
Okay.
I mean, this is actually a issue that has been, and I don't know the social history of this well at all, but this is an issue that had been literally kicking around since the French Revolution. And the church had always managed to prevent dramatic liberalization of divorce laws. And I think that continued until after the war. It's an issue that I believe Simone de Beauvoir wrote about in The Second Sex in 1949. It's like, it's like French divorce laws are, I think, part of the reason that the tolerance level exists.
Yeah. Interesting. Because it's just so weird where Larche is kind of saying, you know, are you going to come back? And she's like, you know, I'm just trying to figure myself out. I'm just, you know, I don't really know what's going on. And I'm like, and they've got this kid that she just thinks she can show up and play. Anyway, the whole thing bananas to me.
There's one thing in that scene that's amazing, which is what he gets upset about. He's upset that Mueller is paying the hotel bill.
Yeah.
Like, that, you know, she, like, the rest he's tolerant of in a upset sort of way, but the idea that his wife is a kept woman for another man offends him, and he does not disguise his disgust at that.
Yeah, and that seems to be what sets him to go and tell Colwitz, like, to put an end to it. Yeah, it's the whole Hortense and it's because there's this funny moment, too. Like, she tells Daniel, and then she goes back and tells Mueller, like, I told Daniel. And he's like, why would you do that? Why doesn't anybody understand this is a toxic person? But okay, whatever. Whatever.
Sarah understands that she's a toxic person.
Sarah does understand it. She gets it, yeah. As the woman de facto raising Hortense's child with Daniel. Okay, so you just mentioned that Kirk got sent away to the Russian front, and I just want to close the loop on this plot point before moving on to a totally other storyline. But part of the reason that this happens, and we talked about this last episode, was the fact that Janine was out for blood after the cake contest. And we weren't quite sure, actually, you weren't quite sure because I did know, but how that retribution would manifest. And it appears to have manifested in Janine sending, like, the cutouts for magazine style ransom notes to these people to, like, out them, right? So she sends a note to Berio about the fact that Lucienne is sleeping with a German soldier.
And then he burns it.
And he burns it up. He's not gonna out her. And Janine comes to check to see if he isn't he sufficiently angry and outraged to have learned this. Like, sidles in and she sees like the partially burned letter in the trash can. And so then she tries another tack and sends one of these letters to Kollwitz himself, and outs Kurt to his commanding officer, which is what gets him sent to the Russian front. Because prior to this, he had a plan he was going to get transferred to back to Germany because he was a good soldier and he was going to send for Marie. And, God, I'm just like, why am I? I'm so into Marie. I can't like remember Lucienne's name. He's going to send for Lucienne and like introduce her to his parents, and she's going to learn German and they're going to live happily ever after. And she's ready to go. But Jeanine torches the whole thing.
Yes. Jeanine sends another one of these poison pill anonymous letters to the German commander, who locks Kurt up and has him transferred to Krakow, to the which is, you know, on the eastern side. The percentage of German soldiers who died during the war, who died on the Eastern Front, is extremely high. Being sent to Russia as almost a code in this. And of course, it gets much worse when the Germans get bogged down in Stalingrad, at Stalingrad in 43. But the Western Front at this stage, this is before Normandy, of course, and so the Western Front is largely peaceful. There's no fighting going on. There's a supposedly mustering for an invasion of Britain, but this, of course, never materializes. And so the Western Front is mostly stable until Normandy, with the exception of there was a fair bit of live action, first in Africa, North Africa, and then in Sicily and in the Italian peninsula. But mostly, if you're on the Western Front here now, you're not seeing active fighting. If you are on the Eastern Front, this is the height of Operation Barbarossa. Russia is losing huge amounts of territory, and the casualties, particularly on the Russian side, are, you know, unlike anything ever in the history of warfare before, except, you know, like the Somme and but this is one of the ugliest, I think this is the single ugliest set of battles over time in kind of the history of the world. So information is trickling back about that, and people know that getting sent to Russia is a really, really bad thing. It is used as punishment. And in this case, it is used as a punishment for an wholly anticipatable punishment. I mean, Kurt, they're keeping it secret for a reason. An important thing about this scene where at the preparation for the Catherinette's party, where Jeanine, where Berio, in I think his finest moment so far in the show, confronts Jeanine about it and says, you know, I know it was you. And this is Berio at his most attractive and least self-interested. He's angry. And the script writers here do something I think really, really interesting in her response, which is she can't accuse him of being a Jew because he's not. She accuses him of Jew loving because he wants to have Madame Morhange sing, and Morhange is a Jew. And then she accuses him of being a Freemason, talks about how when the National Revolution from Vichy happens, and remember, she is the daughter of somebody never described in detail, but who is a Vishy muckety muck, a businessman who's very high up and connected in Vishy. So she is here spouting the rhetoric of Vishy, and we're going to deal with the Jews and the Freemasons and the undesirable elements. And this is actually extremely accurate. Freemasonry was, other than Jews, one of the big bugaboos of you know, Nazi and you know, allied fascist and authoritarian movements. And so when you're confronted by somebody who's a, you know, a schoolmaster who's clearly not a Jew, what can you accuse him of? Well, you can accuse him of being a Freemason. And this is, you know, and she says, you know, we're going to clean up and there's going to be no place in the New France for people like you. And this is, I think, a very good, and by the way, that trope that, you know, Freemasons and Jews, it's like, it remains, you know, if you go to the far right corners of the interwebs now, you know, the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world are still a little bit focused on Freemasonry and these idea that there are kind of secret societies that secretly rule everything and control things. And so this is a very accurate account of Vichy rhetoric from that period and Vichy obsessions, right? You need a term that includes secret collaborator, secret societies who aren't Jews. Jews are, of course, a secret international society themselves in the right-wing imagination and some parts of the left-wing imagination. But you need a term that that inspires that same account of internationalism and cabals and conspiracy for non-Jews. And one is communism, which of course had an element of truth to it, and the other was Freemasonry. And so I just flag that for you, that this is the script writers being very sophisticated about Vichy era ideology of the far right.
Yeah. What I loved about this second episode is it does give you a whiff of Berio's politics. And it's not just her accusation, which you're sort of like, I don't even know. Like, for me, that kind of like went over my head. Like, what's she even, you know, from context, she's accusing him of being something bad that could get him in trouble. But he kind of rolls off him. But there's this scene at the end of the second episode. It's a great scene. And dancing is clearly verboten, just like in Footloose. And so this idea of Morhange singing, there's also then this sort of dancing and, you know, he's being funny. Like, you just, I remember starting to like love Berio during this time because his politics was clearly that of a kind of snarky way of looking at, like, you can tell suddenly that he has a resistance to what is going on, and it becomes apparent in these sort of jokingly little ways, like, we're gonna, if this person is singing and your body spontaneously starts to move and perhaps you know he's just sort of joking around about, you know, we're gonna dance,
but he's telling them to dance.
Yeah, he's telling them to dance,
and he's giving them permission, and he's doing it in a anti-authoritarian liberal way, you know, and he knowingly asks the Jew who lost her job that he now holds to sing at this event, and then he tells people to dance when she's singing. It's a pretty brave moment.
Yeah, if the stakes weren't so high, you'd call it cheeky, but the stakes are like life and death, so it actually is quite brave. And it also has that sort of light touch where you've got, you know, Servier is there going, is he drunk? Like, why is he acting like this?
Because but then Servier dances with his wife.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a, and so he does it in a way that's subtle enough and gentle enough that he kind of breaks down the authoritarianism a little bit And it's clearly, it's sort of a joke, and maybe he's drunk, and so people don't mind, even the authority figures. And by the way, they really want to dance, so they use it as an excuse. Yeah. And it's a very savvy set of moves, and you kind of wish he were more of a politician and less of a schoolmaster.
Interesting. Also of note in that scene is Janine, who is just, you know, appalled by everything. Then, as people do start dancing and the tide turns, she looks around for her husband, who she kind of locks eyes with, like, shall we dance? And he just shakes his head in this way that is he has no interest in dancing with her, which is good because she has just sent someone to their death, basically, with her petty revenge notes. Okay, so let's talk about there's a whole other side.
The main plot of these two episodes, you might say.
You might. Is about the communists. And as they continue to plan this attack on the German soldiers, or the German officers, which has been happening in other places, which is why you have these hostages being rounded up. But they've got to pull off a daring mission, right? So if they're going to kill somebody, they need a gun. And so we've got the woman whose son was malnourished, who then turns up again at the communist meeting. Turns out she's the housekeeper at the what's it called? Bertha's, which is
the brothel.
And so she's the housekeeper there. And so she knows when the German soldiers come in to have sex and what they do with their holstered weapons while they're doing it. And so it's important that there are three keys to the service entrance of the brothel, of which she has one. Mrs. Bertha has one, the owner of the brothel, and one has gone missing. Nobody can find it. And so she sees that as the cover to suggest that anybody could come in and steal the gun, which leads to like a both funny but tense scene where Marcel, posing as a plumber, goes to the brothel, sneaks in, and has to kind of sneak in while the German officer and the prostitute are having sex. And because there's a mirror, so it's like ends up being like one of these scenes that the show does really well, where it's both tense but kind of funny. So they're having sex, but there's a mirror, so she sees Marcel in the mirror, and so she switches positions to make sure that the German officer doesn't catch him. And so it's like one of these little instances of somebody kind of helping. By the way, these prostitutes at the brothel are like basically so far some of the best resistance warriors that we've got on the show. And so Marcel is able to grab the gun, complete the mission, get out of there, and take it back to the other communists. But the gun being missing is a real problem.
Yes. Yeah, so I believe, I may be wrong about this, but I believe that the officer whose gun is stolen is also sent to Russia.
100%. Yep.
And so this is a really interesting portrait, right? So it is hard enough for them to get guns. This is the communist network now, and they have no guns, right? So they're trying to steal individual firearms, and they're counting bullets. So when they steal this guy's gun, and you know they can't really do any training with it because they use up their ammunition. And so there's actually a scene where the 12-year-old communist commander is trying to, who clearly doesn't know how to shoot, is trying to use the gun to trying to practice and shoot a bottle, and he can't hit it. And they stop the training because they're like running out of bullets and they need them for the actual assassination. The significance of the third key is critical here, because when Heinrich Müller interrogates the woman whose information was available, It turns out the third key is not missing after all. It is found, and that means that the only way this person could get in, which is Marcel, is for her to have given him her key, which, of course, she denies, and then he tortures out of her the truth, meaning that Marcel is now compromised to the Nazis. And then she goes and tells his brother that she's outed him. So the mayor knows that he's involved somehow, and the Nazis also know.
Yeah, there's an amazing information channel and network between sort of the Hortense sleeping with Mueller, and then with the woman who has been visiting Daniel because her son was malnourished goes to him because Heinrich burns her with a cigarette, which is a signature torture move. And she's got an infected, you know, open wound that she goes to see Daniel about, at which point she confesses. She lies at first. She didn't, like, show up there to tell him. I do think that one of the funny, again, funny tense scenes is Mueller is, like, interrogating both the prostitute and the cleaning woman, our communist, and the prostitute, who showed that real sense of understanding during the arrest of the gun, suddenly, like, seems to have no sense of what she ought not offer, and, like, very helpfully is like, oh, the key's been found, I can go get it for you.
Yeah, but she has no idea what the significance of the key is.
She doesn't, but I will just say they actually set it up by the communist woman saying, you know, that she's not the brightest bulb early on, so that you are kind of aware when she just offers this that it doesn't occur to her, just, like, say less in this moment. You don't need to. I don't help. So anyway, but yeah. So in this now information chain, Daniel knows a lot about what's happening with Marcel, which is that Marcel is planning something because he's gone out to steal a gun. As a result, like, Hortense becomes this go-between, where you can't, I don't want to get ahead of, but it is worth noting that there is an open information channel that presents a lot of problems, with this Hortense Mueller thing. In some ways, it saves Marcel too, right? Like, because Hortense, you know, doesn't want anything to happen to Marcel. And so she does kind of use some attempt to get Mueller to change course. But the change of course is that he's now figured out, like, well, I'll follow Marcel and I'll figure out this whole network and I'll bust them wide open and I'm going to get a big promotion.
Yeah, so he, of course, thinks of, and by the way, just as an investigative matter, that's exactly the right thing to do. You have somebody who you know is part of a network, so you watch him, like, leave it to a sadistic German to be like, no, the first thing we do is arrest the guy and torture him, rather than what would be good investigative practice to say, okay, the first thing we do is we follow him carefully over a long period of time, map the network, and then we can round it up. That said, it falls apart because the woman who dropped her name proceeds to inform his brother that she did. He then tells Marcel, who then alerts loses his tail, grabs Suzanne and goes and informs the cadre. And so they actually take pretty good steps. And that leads to the climactic decision, which is, okay, fall back on plan A, just grab a bunch of hostages. Which is how the episode ends. They've grabbed a bunch of hostages, including the woman who ratted Marcel out. And to be fair to her, she was under extreme duress. He's burning her arm with cigarettes and he threatens her kid.
He brings her son in, which is like, I think there's this natural tendency, or maybe nobody else does this, just me. When somebody's in a position to either give up information or hold their tongue, I'm always thinking, like, how would I do in this situation? How would I react? And, like, whether – I have no idea how true this is. But my assessment of myself is that I would be able to handle the cigarette burning and that I would not talk. I would crack open on the kid, right? Yeah, like, the second they've got your kid, it's over.
Look, I don't think you can blame her at all. And she actually does something very brave, which is to go to – Danielle Larche under the guise of seeking medical attention for the burns on her arm, tells him what happened and tells him that she dropped his brother's name, and that allows him to tip them off. But we should talk about what Larche does at the end of the episode.
Okay.
Because I have some texts on this. So at the end of the episode, he says goodbye to Sarah and puts on his hat and coat and walks into the German high command, the local command headquarters, walks up to Kollwitz and says, "I'm your hostage."
Well, he says, "I've read your code and I know that you have to accept this, and I'm telling you I want to put myself in the place of the hostages."
Right. So I want to read you something.
Please.
And this is – I'm going to read you two things. So this is from a book called Policing and War in Europe. It reads "In the hours following the attack of the 3rd of January, the regional prefect, Joseph Rivaland, was summoned to the Hotel Noailles, where the German general staff instructed him to draw up a list of hostages who would be shot in the event of further incident. In application of a government circular of the 7th of May, 1942, Rivaland refused, and taking a courageous attitude, added that the only hostage he would name was himself. The Germans, irritated by the prefect's intransigence, declared a state of siege and announced that the Marseille police were to pass under direct SS control." So that is one little text. Here is another text from a book called France, the Dark Years by the historian Julian Jackson. This one's a little bit longer. And we'll give some texture to these. So this issue of reprisals for communists doing attacks was a real thing. Reads, "If these measures proved insufficient to stop the German policy of shooting hostages, Vichy at least wanted to limit the unpopularity of that policy. On the 23rd of October, the government proposed cooperation between the French and German police to avoid the Germans shooting the wrong people. Prefects were instructed to hand the Germans lists of those arrested as communists. This was only a step away from the French government selecting French citizens to be shot by the Germans. Anti-communism blunted Vichy's recognition of the invidious territory into which it was straying. But the resistance attacks continued, and the Germans went on exacting their revenge. After a German soldier was shot in Bordeaux on the 20th of October and another at Nantes the same day, the next day." So the Nantes attack is referred to explicitly in the show. It turns out to be a real thing. 98 French hostages were executed. These executions became particularly controversial because Pichot, having managed to get the number of victims reduced, was later accused of having selected the names of communists from among the hostages. He had apparently asked the Germans to spare the names of some people with heroic war records, and then presented with another list containing the names mainly of communists, he kept silent. The executions caused a wave of national outrage, and Pétain decided to present himself as a hostage at the demarcation line. He was talked out of the idea, but news of it spread sufficiently for Pétain to secure credit for it without having to carry it out. In fact, the German reprisals did not let up. 95 more hostages were shot after another resistance attack on the 28th of November. In total, 471 hostages were executed by the Germans between September 1941 and May 1942.
Very interesting. Well, go ahead. Yeah, tell.
No, I was just going to. So that gives you some background both on the policy that the show is depicting, including in this region, and the what specifically Larcher does at the end of this episode, which is that he walks in and presents himself as a hostage, which was something that at least one regional leader, in fact, did. That's the significance of the first text. But also that Pétain himself contemplated doing and was sort of loosely credited with doing, even though he himself never did it.
Yeah. So I'll tell you part of what is... thank you for reading that. That was... look at you bringing resources to the conversation. So this idea of, and I don't think it's a spoiler to talk about this. The thing about the show that most attracts me to it is that right now we are watching how people react under duress, right, and what decisions that they make. But we know from history that at some point they will be judged by the decisions that they make in these moments. And I think this notion of list making comes up again and again. And we've already had it a couple times in the show, right? Very early on, there is the rounding up, the creating a list of the townspeople, the men who are like family men, to put them in the position of you know, finding the person who stole the... I mean, the list making and the hostage taking... That stuff constantly falls to Daniel and to a lesser degree, the deputy prefect, which puts them in this sort of god position. And so I just – it's an interesting thing for you to really draw out of, because I can't tell you how important these things become later on as people are evaluating how people behaved during these moments. But this is Daniel. You are starting to see, right? And this is as the killing of the German officers is accelerating just as it's intended to, the way that the Germans are becoming harsher with the French people, which is creating more pressure on the characters to choose a side. Right, to decide how they're going to behave. And so some of what's interesting that's happening is watching somebody like Berriot, or watching Daniel, or watching Marie, as things start to push them, kind of deciding how they're going to react and what side they're going to be on. That actually would normally be kind of a good place to leave it, but I want to just point out one plot point that happened that we didn't mention, which is that Marcel and Suzanne finally consummate this thing that's been going on between them in this episode, and that's bad. I mean, here's the thing. Then I'll just go back to where we started in the episode, right? Also for Botan, they're not supposed to be doing this, and yet this is the most sane relationship in this entire... It's the most non-toxic, sane, like, you guys belong together relationship in the show.
So on your point about people being judged for drawing up these lists, I want to close with a totally crazy story that illustrates this point. So, and this is going to sound weird and crazy. It is, but it will, I promise it'll come back to your point. In 2012, in the New York Times, I read the greatest obituary I have ever read, which was for a man named Robert de la Rochefoucauld, who is actually a direct lineal descendant of the great Rochefoucauld of the 17th century. And Robert de la Rochefoucauld, who was a is sort of one of the most courageous and celebrated French resistance fighters. He, the obituary, which we can I can include in the show notes, is one of the most swashbuckling things. He literally faced a German firing squad and escaped. He dressed as a nun and escaped from prison. He was like, you know, all the while working for the British. Fabulous story. And here is the weird part about it. Later in his life, he spoke out in defense of a man named Maurice Papon, who was accused by the French of being a war criminal. And Papon was accused and convicted, ultimately, and of choosing, he was a police official, and he was accused of deporting French Jews to be killed in concentration camps while he was a Vichy official. And de la Rochefoucauld, who had impeccable credentials as a resistance figure, not only testified on Papon's behalf that he was a courageous resistance person who had, as a Vichy official, helped the resistance and the Allies. But he then, when Papon made a run for it and went to Switzerland, he used de la Rochefoucauld's passport to register in a hotel, and de Rochefoucauld had given him his passport. And so I've thought about this a lot over the years, like, how should I understand and de la Rochefoucauld was incredibly courageous, and like, the obit is worth reading just for his swashbuckling and the answer is, maybe Papon had a little bit of Daniel Larcher in him, right? He's trying to manage a difficult situation. The Germans need lists of Jews to kill. He's providing those lists of Jews. He's also helping de la Rochefoucauld on the side. That strikes me as, now, how do we evaluate that morally and legally? I don't know, but like, I can totally see the argument that he is both a war criminal and somebody who helped, you know, somebody who was incredibly courageous and, you know, in the resistance. And I think there are these people who did both. And I have no reason to doubt de la Rochefoucauld's account of what Papon did. And I also have no reason to doubt that he caused a lot of Jews to get killed and deserved to be convicted and punished for that. So, yeah, your point that eventually all of these decisions about who is on what list, that is also a true thing that happened that there was accountability for probably not enough people.
Yeah, well, you can see, and I guess, again, without getting ahead of ourselves, how Daniel has put himself in a position where he has to make decisions. He's being told he has to make decisions. And so the humanist in him is constantly trying to figure out how to limit damage to people. But he is still making decisions that lead to damage for some. And whereas somebody else who just kept their head down was involved in, you know, was in none of it, maybe even just kind of casually participated, was a collaborator, maybe turned in a Jewish neighbor or two, they are never put in a position to make a list. And so it's just this is I think and also these moves that Daniel makes that are self-sacrificing.
And also, if you argue that the married men with families and with great war records should not be on the list, and you thereby save them, are you, in fact, by doing that, accountable for the list of people who are communists who are on the list?
That's right. And we see at the beginning of the episode, the very beginning, is Marcel reading a list of the name of people who were executed as a result of the dead officers. And he just keeps reading that they were communists, you know, and he is, I think in some ways it's, I don't know if it's dawning on him because he seems to know it, but it clearly it's emotionally very taxing for him. But, you know, what he's realizing is like, when it comes to finding the people who are expendable for these things, they are killing us. Now, to be fair, or I don't know about fair, but like the reality was it was the communists who were the ones shooting the officers. So it also, there's a reason that they were being targeted, right? They were the early parts of the resistance.
Right. But they were not, they were being targeted not on the basis of their individual participation, but on their basis right. of their
affiliation. Yeah, that makes sense. I'm just going to throw out one other smallish thing about the episode, which is there's a lot of names thrown around of French things. Like there was a French places that actually are things now. So like at one point they talk about something happening at Chardonnay and Chateaubriand, and they talk about something at Artois. And I just keep hearing like beer, wine.
Well, you know, a lot of French wines are named for regions. And, you know, De Gaulle said, it was impossible to govern a country with 350 kinds of cheese. at least that's the legend. I don't know if he really said it. Well, we should wrap up, Sarah.
Yeah, great talk. And we will be back next week to do episodes 7 and 8. We are on the back half of season 2, both the shows and our own. We will see if we get picked up for season 3.
And in the meantime, Edith, take us home.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement. Homme t'aime tous les amants. Et puis un jour, tu m'as quitté. Depuis je t'aime.